lunch, I have to do.
House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is Wednesday, April 12th. First item on the agenda today, we're going to go to House Bill 3078. We're going to have 15 minutes aside on this, and I'm going to set a timer so it'll go off in 10 minutes, so you'll know you'll have about five left. And we're going to limit each side of that because we have so many bills we need to get through. And so I will call up Shannon White, Ken Thrasher, and Gary Kolb. And open a public hearing on House Bill 3078.
And Representative Sanchez.
Please.
Representative Kleinger's up there too.
Okay. I'm sorry.
Carla.
Is Carla here too?
Okay.
I'm going to do this, right? Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3078 modifies repeat property offender sentences. It reduces presumptive sentences from 24 months and 18 months to 19 months and 13 months, respectively, reduces presumptive sentences applicable to specified property crimes, increases the number of predicate convictions necessary for repeat offender sentence to apply from 1 or 2 to 4, and eliminates specified predicate convictions, authorizes the court to impose downward dispositional departures from a presumptive sentence. The bill also authorizes the Department of Corrections to reduce the term of incarceration for up to 6 months if inmate meets specified criteria, including participation in parenting-related programming, modifies the Family Sentencing Alternative Pilot Program, and increases the maximum period of short-term transitional leave from 90 days to 180 days. The bill also makes appropriations for Family Sentencing Alternative Pilot Program, Justice Reinvestment Program, and Domestic and Sexual Violence Services Fund. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Please go ahead and... Go.
Good afternoon, Judiciary Committee. For the record, my name is Carla Peluso. I represent House District 50 in Gresham. As many of you know, I have spent the last 6 months delving into the women's prison population crisis, along with Senator Winters, to see what caused it and how we can avoid spending millions on a new prison for women. While we've made some progress with work release programs, as it stands now, our prison for women is still over capacity, and we are using more than 120 temporary and emergency beds in Coffee Creek alone. This puts everyone in that prison, workers and prisoners, in a terrible position. As you also know, I come to this issue as a former police chief who spent 30 years in law enforcement. Clearly, I believe in holding people accountable when they make bad choices. I also know the best public safety outcomes are achieved when we use our common sense and evidence-based approaches, and that this will benefit not just those being convicted, but also correctional officers and victims. Community safety always has been and will continue to be my top priority. When I arrested women with their children watching, I knew I was altering their lives forever. Many of these mothers were in domestic violence situations or struggling with addiction or mental illness. Nothing pains an officer more than to find out that our system isn't addressing the underlying problem and that you have to go back to arrest the same woman over and over, or even worse, their children 10 years later. Many in the law enforcement community in Oregon are already leading the way towards a smarter approach. Marion County has a successful program that diverts people from addiction-driven crime that is being replicated in Lane and Clackamas counties. Multnomah County is launching a law enforcement-assisted diversion program that sends people to treatment and services instead of prison. Justice reinvestment programs across the state are also making a huge impact. But these pockets of great work are not enough to address the crisis we are in. DOC has already cut 144 treatment beds, and adjustment reinvestment and community corrections programs are at risk of being cut, all in order to fund expensive, lengthy prison stays. The 2008 law that created longer mandatory minimum sentences for addiction-driven drug and property crime was meant to go after big-time drug kingpins, but it is now scooping up low-level addicts, and it is costing taxpayers millions to house, not rehabilitate, them, especially when faced with the $1.7 billion budget deficit. We need to ensure we are investing taxpayer dollars in what works to address the root causes of addiction-driven crime, reduce recidivism and future crime, and keep our communities safe. Thank you for your time and consideration of House Bill 3078.
Thank you.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Tana Sanchez, and I represent House District 43, North and Northeast Portland. As you know, I've been the Director of Family Services at NAIA Family Center for the past 20 years, and in that capacity, I've worked with women and families developing wraparound services and variant models for victims of domestic violence, looking for ways to help, looking for ways to change and move things in a different way to help people rebuild their lives after these issues. In my volunteer life, I've been a volunteer at Coffee Creek Correctional Facility for many years as well, and I've seen a lot of change and a lot of shift in that population, sadly enough. I'm here today with, along with Rep. Peluso and Rep. Leininger, to ask for your support of House Bill 3078, the Saving and Safeties Act. Safety and savings. My gosh, I can't get that one right. We ask for your support in continuing a very important conversation about how to most effectively invest our public safety dollars to address the root causes of addiction-driven drug and property crime and our ballooning women's prison population. With only 5% of the world's population, the U.S. has more than 20% of the world's prison population. That makes us the world's biggest incarcerator. And in Oregon, we're no exception with our 14 prisons and our, I think it's 14,000, isn't it? Somewhere around there that we have.
Over 15.
Yeah. We're also no exception to drug and property crime incarceration that disproportionately impacts women and people of color. Native women often face the brunt of this inequity. I support House Bill 3078 because my experience working with countless women at Coffee Creek, many of whom were victims of domestic violence, suffer from addiction, and are often coming from a place of extreme poverty. I'm also supporting this act because people in my district have been disproportionately impacted by crime and incarceration. Oregon's children and families are being torn apart by a system of over-incarceration that does not address the root causes of crime, nor provide adequate resources for victims, or invest in the incredible human potential of many who are currently struggling. House Bill 3078 realigns drug and property crime sentencing laws to ensure that we can invest in solutions that provide adequate resources to victims and ensure we address the underlying causes of addiction-driven drug and property crime. I appreciate your support in this bill.
Thank you. Representative Leininger, please.
Thank you, Chair Barker. Members of the committee, I'm Ann Leininger from House District 38, Lake Oswego in Southwest Portland. I, too, urge you to support House Bill 3078. Thanks to good work of many people in this room, the Justice Reinvestment Act was passed on supporting the theory that there is a better way for us to use public resources, there's a better way for us to achieve safety in our communities, and there's a more humane way for us to deal with people who are struggling with addiction. The work now has a logical extension, and that is passing House Bill 3078, the Safety and Savings Act, that will enable us to both continue more appropriately helping people who are committing crimes as a result of their untreated addictions, help us avoid opening a women's prison if we can avoid it at a time when we have a $1.7 billion budget deficit. This matters to me because I come from a family where a lot of people have struggled with addiction. I have a young cousin who has had a lot of, has a number of felonies related to his addiction and faces a real risk of having his probation revoked and going to prison next week. I think that one of the things that is important is we need stronger addiction treatment programs for people who struggle in that way, and this bill helps provide a path for that. I think you're going to hear a couple things in opposition to this bill, and I would like to talk to you about those in advance. One of the things you may hear is that this sentencing reform would be contrary to a deal with district attorneys that was struck in 2003, or you may hear that it is counter to the will of voters in 2008, or it somehow undermines truth in sentencing. And I would like to add some things to your frame of reference as you consider those arguments. A lot has changed since this bill, the Justice Reinvestment Act was passed 5 years ago. This bill would actually go into effect in 2018, so it would be a full 5 years after. And it's been 10 years since sentences were increased. Thank you. The community realizes that addiction is a key issue we need to address. And incarceration without more is not getting the job done. We need both addiction treatment programs, we need supportive housing that is clean and sober housing, and we need the good sobering centers that Representative Stark has supported. And we also have a $1.7 billion deficit. This is a prospective bill, not retroactive, and it would enable district attorneys and judges to be clear with people, including victims, about possible sentences. So I think there are good people in this room from a range of perspectives who are going to talk about this bill today, but I hope you will look closely at moving it forward in its current form or in some modified form, because it's very important. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you.
I'd also love to distribute this chart about what a variety of scenarios would look like.
Yes.
Thanks.
Give me a stand, please. Okay, thank you, panelists. Okay, now we'll call Shannon White, Ken Trasher, and Gary Kolb. Shannon, you only have 2 minutes left.
Okay. I have 2 minutes left, thanks.
We didn't count the legislators.
Okay.
Time.
I will watch the clock. Chair Barker, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Shannon White. I'm the Deputy Director with Partnership for Safety and Justice, here testifying in support of House Bill 3078, along with co-sponsors Rep. Sanchez, Rep. Peluso, and Rep. Leininger. This bill really comes to you out of a recognition that we were on the brink, and we still are on the brink, of opening a second prison for women. Even today, the Coffee Creek Correctional Facility stands at about 1280, which is its maximum capacity. And that puts us at risk of spending $17.5 million in the next biennium for a population of women that we know is 70% of whom are drug addicted. Many have been victims of domestic violence. And we need to spend those resources more wisely. We will likely be amending this bill in ways to recognize some very hard work that's gone on in a work group that Tina Kotek pulled together. And so I want to assure you that there's been a lot of thought put into all the issues involved in this bill. And I also want to make sure you understand the driving values behind the bill. And the first is that we truly, I think, know from evidence and believe that whether someone gets sentenced to prison or probation for 19 months or 24 months is not what matters most. What matters most is that we ensure that those folks have the best public safety outcomes. And we know that the reforms that we're proposing in this bill get us to that, get us closer to that. And the second is, and we always want to be really clear about this, we can't not send people to prison or send them for a shorter period of time without reinvesting into programs and services to actually meet those needs, whether that's housing or addiction treatment, transition services. We want to make sure that we know that savings created from this will go into the places where it's most needed. And that's why the bill's structured the way it is, with the sort of sentencing reforms and then the reinvestment priorities for justice reinvestment and victim services. You're about to give me time. So just quickly going through the bill, and I did, I think, touch base with all of your offices today, because I know this hearing's a little rushed, and I don't think there will be a vote on it today, and we're happy to answer more questions tomorrow in person to help let other people who want to testify, testify. But the bill fundamentally, it's divided into five sections. The first one addresses reforms to our mandatory drug and property crime laws. These are repeat drug and property offenses that we increased back in 2008. We think those need to be realigned to do what we know works best and what we've seen, as others have already pointed out, being done in, I think, Marion and Multnomah and other counties to more adequately address this particular population that really is addiction-driven. I won't go into detail on the family sentencing alternative. We testified on that last week. That is also included in this bill, the expansion to make more custodial parents eligible for diversion from prison. And finally, the other sentencing reform is expanding short-term transition leave. There's been a study by the CJC to look at 2 years' worth of expanded short-term transition leave. To date, that's showing savings and lower recidivism rates, so we think increasing that is exactly the kind of reform that we need now. And then finally, as I mentioned before, making sure that saved funds go into justice reinvestment and the Oregon Domestic and Sexual Violence Services Fund, all of which, given this $1.7 billion budget deficit, are facing cuts and are really going to undermine our public safety infrastructure. So thank you for allowing us to continue this critical conversation, and we hope you'll support the bill.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Barker, committee members. My name is Gary Cobb. I'm the Community Outreach Coordinator at Central City Concern in Portland, Oregon. And I'm here today to testify as an agency and a member of OPERA, which is a group of Oregon providers with addiction services and housing that we encourage you to, and we strongly support House Bill 3078. And my testimony is submitted, and I'm not going to read it, but I want to share with you a little bit. Me personally who spent 25 years living the life of a criminal activity, addiction. I would get arrested. I would cycle in through the system. I had no clear direction of how to kind of really stop all this. It would momentarily stop that behavior, but once I got released, I would pick it right back up again. November 2000, I had an opportunity to get into a more structured setting that helped me deal with my addiction, my criminality, just my whole way of thinking how I looked at life. As a result of that, I've been clean for a little over 16 years and also a homeowner. What this bill also does for folks like me that experience that, it not only helps create, stops that mechanism, that addiction, that criminal behavior, it helps them stay safe, it helps the community stay safe, but what you end up doing is investing in these folks where we become taxpayers and we pay back into the system, we become peer mentors, we get opportunities to get a job working on the law enforcement assisted diversion program that we're starting, and that's pretty exciting to me, to be in a position to finally help someone that for me, I never got that opportunity back in the day. And I think that we're on to something here, and I think we just need to continue to listen to everybody that's in the room and come to the solution. But more importantly, find out, when we talk about what all we save here, but also what else we can get with this investment. Folks can get clean, and they can stop their criminal behavior. Thank you for letting me testify.
Chair Barker and committee members, my name is Kenneth Thrasher. I'm a retired business person, a member of the Oregon Business Council Poverty Task Force, and I'm testifying in support of the Safety and Savings Act, House Bill 3078, which is also endorsed by OBA and AOI through the Oregon Business Plan. You know, I've served on the board previously of a house, halfway house, called the Northwest Regional Reentry Center, when we grew it from 15 to now 125 clients served, both men and women. Our goal was to use intervention strategies for early release, societal reentry, housing, and job placement service to reduce recidivism. We did a really good job. I also have mentored a parolee, giving them a job and seeing them flourish in college, get a degree, have a family, and have a successful career. So these programs can work. Oregon's on the brink of opening, as you all know, another women's prison, because of the increasing women prison population. The vast majority of these women have been convicted of addiction-driven crimes. They have histories of trauma or mental health issues, including ACE factors, that need to be addressed through treatment, not incarceration. Additionally, 75% of them are mothers, which means the children are pretty much handled now by the state and are separated from their primary caregiver. And my experience shows that these intervention strategies have about an 8-to-1 payback versus putting these people in prison. So I think we really need to target the cost drivers of the correction system and the strategies to better improve outcomes for these women. I think we can much more effectively achieve accountability and those outcomes through interventions and reduce sentencing. And I think that, you know, I'm not going to go through the various components because you all know them and I've submitted testimony, but I just think that based on my experience and seeing people that have gone through the system and the opportunity, when you provide the right interventions, the right mentoring programs, the right supports, that they can be very, very successful in their life and careers and families. And so I think not making that kind of investment in capital, but placing it in people is much more important today. So I'm here to support House Bill 3078, and I hope you will as well. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next call, Paul Steigleiter, Sarah Brennan, and Elizabeth Hatcher. There's about 7 minutes left.
Chair Barker and members of the House Judiciary Committee, for the record, my name is Elizabeth Hacker. Earlier this month, I was with my oldest daughter when we learned that she was accepted to Stanford University. It was one of the most joyous moments of my life, not just because she had turned her dream into a reality, but because I had just been reunited with her and my other children after 2.5 years of being in and out of jail. My history is not that much different from many women's in Oregon. As a young woman, I got myself caught up in a cycle that included abusive relationships and poor choices that eventually led to my addiction. By the time I was 30, I was in a survival mode that felt bigger than me. Also, like many women in Oregon, it was a cycle that led to my incarceration. I don't make excuses for myself. I'm sober now, and a part of my recovery involves taking responsibility for the harm that I've caused, and I work at that every day. At the same time, another part of my recovery involves learning to accept the parts of my past where I was a victim of abuse and addiction. The bottom line was I needed help. When I was 23, I spent 3 months working as a missionary in Africa. We were there to help people find faith, but their conditions were too dire for that. They were hungry, they were unsheltered, and they were sick, many of them with AIDS. It was obvious that they needed basic services and healing before they could think beyond their survival modes. So we delivered that for them. We provided housing, we provided schooling, we provided healthcare. Most importantly, we provided the space for them to hope and for them to find God. It was very hard and emotional 3 months for me, but it taught me a profound lesson, the heart of which is at the heart of the Safety and Savings Act. People need basic healing before they can thrive. As of last week, I'm 1 year clean, and I only reached that milestone because I had the resources to upright my life, to get out of a cycle of abusive relationships, to be a better mother to my 4 amazing children, and to have a job that allowed me to take my family out to dinner to celebrate Stanford. I feel lucky to have had the treatment and services that I needed, but I'm not more special than anyone else I got to know in jail. Other women have children and families and hopes and dreams. Other women need help. I urge you to support those families by supporting House Bill 3078.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Chair Barker, member of the committee, I am Sarah Brennan. I am the operations manager at the Center for Hope and Safety. We serve victims of domestic and sexual violence here in Marion County, and I've been an advocate for survivors for over a dozen years. I, too, have submitted written testimony, and I urge you to support this bill, and I'm here on the agency's behalf to endorse it as well. I had the opportunity a few years ago to use my advocacy skills with women in Coffee Creek Correctional Facility, and the time I spent meeting with those women was a profound impact for me in understanding what caused some of them to be incarcerated. And I will tell you that every individual that I worked with there, every single one was there because of crimes, either influenced by or addiction-driven crimes that were a result of coping with domestic violence. And one individual in particular had pled guilty to a crime that she didn't actually commit because her abuser had committed the crime. His sentence would have been greater, and he charmed her into taking the blame for himself. When I look at this bill, I see the difference it could make in the lives of these women and their children in really helping put the focus on their reunification and helping them find the resources out there. I also love that it redirects funds to proactive agencies that, like ours, that are helping to cut off problems earlier as opposed to reacting to them. I would love to see a lot more domestic violence shelter beds rather than needing extra beds at Coffee Creek. like they have right now. I just want to thank you all for listening and urge you to support this bill. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker and members of the committee. My name is Paul Steigletter, and I'm here on behalf of the Law Enforcement Action Partnership in partnership with the safety and justice folks. And I'm asking you to support 3078. Shortly after coming into the room, I was told that my opinion is completely wrong. And so you're going to hear from folks that are going to say that, basically. I'm a law enforcement officer that retired after 30 years with the Clackamas County Sheriff's Office. And I saw firsthand the results of arresting people, putting them into the system, hoping that they're going to get treatment, and then seeing them come out again, and they didn't get the treatment they needed. It's been offered that we can look at two of the people that I mentioned, Anthony and Julie, and later we can see where they're at now. We can't go back in time. We can't go back and see what happened to Anthony before he got arrested numerous times for property-related crimes that were driven by his drug addiction. We can't go back in time and look what happened to Julie when she was born into a multi-generational family that was dysfunctional because of drugs and alcohol. We can't do that. All we can do as a society is take steps forward. What we're doing doesn't work. What we're doing doesn't work. Measure 57 has some flaws, and we need to go back and look at it. Bring in judicial ability to make their decisions. We can't do a cookie-cutter approach to handling public health issues. We can't use a cookie-cutter approach to work with drug addiction issues. We can fix an addiction. We can't fix a conviction. This isn't just a rural problem or a metro problem. This is a statewide problem. This is a national problem. We're currently number one, as was mentioned here, as far as incarceration rates in the world. We need to do something different. We can take a portion of the money saved by eliminating some of the tenets of Measure 57 and add treatment beds, add beds for domestic violence victims, intervene at the very start, and hope that we can actually impact how many people we put in jail, how many people we deprive of their mothers, how many people we deprive of their sisters, and all those different things. We can make a difference. We have an opportunity. I would just go ahead and close up by saying that I'm a local boy. I went to the University of Portland. I got my degree in sociology, and it was in society and justice. Not criminal justice, society and justice. And I didn't realize until just recently that there's a reason for that. It's called society and justice. We have a role as members of the society to seek justice. Measure 57 is flawed. 3078 will work towards correcting some of those flaws. We have the opportunity to make a difference. Please consider making a difference.
Okay, thank you very much, panel. And we're going to, because of time, we have to do questions offline. So that's the first 15 minutes. So the second 15 minutes, I'll call John Foote, Steve Dole, and that's the only people who signed up against the bill. 15 minutes.
Good afternoon. Chair Barker, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee. My name is John Foote. I'm the elected DA in Clackamas County, where I've had the privilege of serving I'm in my 17th year. Just before I say some things, I want to tell you a little bit about myself. I've been in the business 37 years. I spent 5 years as a defense attorney. I spent 10 years in the courtroom prosecuting cases. I spent 5 years in leadership at the Department of Corrections, where I was an assistant director and the inspector general, and later the acting director for 6 months. I bring to you all that experience. I am a very active person in nonprofits that deal with at-risk populations. I was a counselor for emotionally disturbed high school kids before I went to law school. We are not unfeeling people. We care about people at risk. But this bill is wrong, and I want to tell you why. This bill takes us back to the 1980s on that path. And I can tell you, I worked in the 1980s when there was no truth in sentencing. There was no proportional punishment. And the people who addressed that were Hardy Myers and Neil Goldsmith, because they saw how broken it was. And we have a very strong reaction to this. Backdoor releases erode public confidence. If you want to reduce sentences, do it. But don't let people out the back door. No one knows what sentences mean anymore. We've been down this road. Please do not do this again. We've given you this report from the DA's Association. I encourage you to read it. Now, I've got a lot of experience doing a lot of different things, but this is the best public safety system I've ever worked in. This is the safest Oregon I have ever lived in. It took years, decades of hard work to get us here. We're rewriting history. Read it. We have the lowest crime rates. We have a relatively low incarceration rate. We have truth in sentencing, and we have proportional punishment. I was one of the people that negotiated Measure 57 with the legislature, with Senator Przanski. I took that initiative as the president of the DA's Association because Measure 61 was on the ballot. You remember. And Measure 61 had mandatory minimums for property crime, which we did not want. So we proposed an alternative without mandatory minimums within the structure of the repeat property offender statute that was already in place. That's what 57 was. The legislature added mandatory minimums for drug dealers. We did not. That's the background. The minute that measure defeated 61, guess what happened? We were told it cost too much and it was going to be suspended. We felt like we'd been manipulated. Now we're here again. I was one of the people that negotiated. I was on the commission that created the idea of the 3194, the governor's sentencing commission. I was heavily involved in the negotiations on 3194. I know there's a lot of argument about technicalities and when the deal expires. Come on, we had a deal. I remember talking to the chief of staff of Neil Goldsmith when we were negotiating, and he said, well, what would it take to make a deal? And I said, well, how do we know we can believe anything you do? And he said, what if we made you a promise we wouldn't touch anything for a while? And I said, well, that would help. That's where this idea came from, because we don't see the deals kept. Now, on the flip side, we've done what you've asked. Look at the prison forecast. Look at it on pages, we gave you the copies, pages 8 and 9, and look what it says. The prisons are forecast to grow 4% in the next 10 years. The population of the state is going to grow 12%. You tell me another state agency that's made a commitment to grow that slowly. Hold them to the same standard you're holding corrections. The women's prison population is projected to grow 11 inmates in 10 years. Less than 1%. It's in black and white. There's no crisis about prisons. And even if it, and I was in corrections, I know about the challenges of running a prison, but there's an empty prison over there that can be rebooted up if it ever comes to that. I don't know why the one we have was built too small, but this is not a crisis. We've done so much good. Finally, I need to say this about, when we heard the conversation about women in prison, we were given the 58 female offenders that our county sent to prison last year. It was 59, I think. And we looked at them. I've got the chart right here. Guess how many prior convictions those 59 female offenders had? 457. Let me repeat that. 59 offenders, 457 prior convictions. These are not first-time offenders we're sending. We're human beings. We care about people. Finally, two things. You never hear about victims anymore. Criminals are now being discussed as if they're victims. Criminals are people. They need to be. We need to think about how to deal with them. That hasn't changed. That's always been true. But they are not victims in the crimes they commit. The real victims, if you say they're victims, you are diminishing what a real victim is in a crime. I'm sitting next to one. They're just not here. So do good things for criminals, but they're not victims. Finally, it pains me to say this, but you know the system, part of the system that's not working very well? It's recidivism. I have the chart here somewhere. Where did I put it? Recidivism rates today are higher than they were when the law that created evidence-based practices was passed in 2003, which is a good principle. We need evidence-based practices passed into law in 2003. The recidivism rates today are higher. Nobody's talking about that. I'm not saying put all those people in prison. I'm just saying this idea that we know how to make everyone not be a criminal is a false narrative. It is. We know from personal experience how hard it is to change human behavior. It is really hard. All we have to do is look at ourselves. Hardest thing I ever did was quit smoking. I quit 500 times before I finally quit. Long time ago, but it stayed with me. I know how hard this is. I'm not saying it's easy. So let's stop saying that we have all the answers. Because if we're wrong, guess who gets hurt? Real victims. That's who gets hurt. So I just encourage you to not go down this road for all the reasons I've said. First of all, it's a violation of the agreements we've had. And second of all, it's you'll regret it. You'll just, and Oregon will regret it. This is a good system we have now. I know there are a lot of people in the room who don't think so, but the data is just irrefutable. So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Steve Dole, and I am president of Crime Victims United. Since 1983, the largest standing crime victims organization in the state of Oregon. In preparation for today's hearing, I went through all of the testimony that had been posted last night. There was lots of comments about budget shortfalls and cost savings in women's prisons. There were references to addictions and treatment. There was at least one story about an individual whose drug use allegedly forced her into a life of crime. Through all of it, beyond funding for services, there is exactly one reference to the people who have the biggest stake in this system. The people who are hurt, the people who are injured, the crime victims. And that reference had nothing to do with their loss or with their or with the trauma surrounding their victimization. It had to do rather with a recommendation placing the burden of telling those victims the truth about back-end sentence cuts on the prosecutors. Hey, Mr. and Mrs. Victims, we got some bad news. Here's the sentence, but. The other thing I didn't read about was reducing crime. I read a lot about reducing sentences, but not much about crime reduction. In fact, nothing about crime reduction. I'm not surprised. House Bill 3078 is not about protecting victims. It's about cutting sentences. It's about saving money. It's about shifting the costs of crime away from the state and onto the backs of the businesses and individuals who are victimized. It's about turning back the clock to a time in which Oregon had the dubious distinction of being one of the nation's most crime-ridden states. Since 1992, when my daughter Lisa, who was 12 years old at the time, was murdered, I spent most of my adult life trying to protect the rights of victims and, equally important, endeavoring to reduce the number of victims of crime. This is the last place I thought I would be at 67 years old. This is the last thing I thought I would be doing at 67 years old. As Mr. Foote noted, we have fundamentally changed Oregon over the last 25 years, and for the better. That's what most of the people outside that window think. Maybe not in this building, but the voters, the citizens of this state, the majority, and they've showed that time after time. The change has been accomplished based on two fundamental principles. The first principle is proportional punishment, what Harding Myers liked to refer to as just deserts. On this mark, Oregon has long been a national leader. We have never put people in prison for simple drug possession. property offenders and drug dealers go to prison based on the number of crimes they have committed and the number of people they have victimized. Violent offenders are sentenced based on the depravity of their behavior and the vulnerability of their victims. Proportional punishment serves two vital roles. One, it sends a message to the citizens about the community's expectations for their behavior, and it acknowledges to victims that those who have violated their personal rights will be held accountable. The second principle is truth in sentencing. The sentence said is a sentence served. Truth in the criminal justice system is, like many areas of life, based on honesty between individuals, between institutions, between individuals and institutions. Trust is based on being honest with the person you're sitting down with. When we say something, we should mean it. When offenders commit a crime and society has an expectation they will serve 2 years, they assume the offender will serve 2 years. When that offender serves a year or 11 months, society loses its trust in the criminal justice system. Victims, too, have an expectation of truth. When they report a crime, they have an expectation of justice. It is often what drives their decision to report the crime. When they lose faith that justice will be administered, they stop reporting crime. Truth in sentencing is what gives the community faith in the justice system and ultimately how crime is stopped. For decades, these principles were not part of our criminal justice system. Tired of being victimized and losing faith, voters finally took action. Tired of being victimized by violent crime, they passed Measure 11 in 1994 by 67%. And in 2000, when some wanted to throw it out, the voters said no, 74% of them. Then in 2008, fed up with property crime, they passed both Measure 61 and Measure 57, both of which demanded accountability from repeat property offenders. The voters got exactly what they asked for: less crime, fewer victims, and safer communities. Instead of celebrating our successes, this bill will dismiss it and diminish it. Finally, House Bill 3078 is brazen in its effort to undo Oregon's effective sentencing policies and to unwind the will of Oregon's voters. It erodes proportional punishment by repealing Measure 57. It eviscerates truth in sentencing by doubling back-end sentence reductions just two sessions after they were doubled. And it does both of these under the false premise of cost savings. It is not cost savings. It is a cost shift. It puts the financial burden on the back of the crime victims. Oregon will recognize this wolf in sheep's clothing, and they will not stand by idly. If it passes, I can assure you that it is a matter of time until the voters will again, as they have time after time, restore proportional punishment and demand truth in sentencing. Crime Victims United strongly opposes this bill and encourages you to do the same. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. We'll go ahead. We didn't have questions for this, so we won't ask questions here. So thank you very much. Close
thank you very much.
Thank you.
Paperwork's not ready. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3078. Open a. I apologize to those who didn't get a chance to testify, but we just have tough time restraints on that. So. Stop.
Do you need help with that?
Yeah, it looks like I'm there now. Okay. So which one's okay? Okay. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3274. Call Representatives Gomberg and Caddy, please.
Representative
Caddy.
Representative,
I say?
Caddy McKeon.
Representative
Gomberg. You say House District 9 and 10.
Good
come
afternoon. Up. And if you don't mind, we'd like to bring up Ms. Miles.
Ruth? Yeah.
There she is. All right.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3274 modifies an existing public records exemption for the Office of Small Business Assistance. There's a Dash 4 amendment that modifies the public records exemption for the Office of Small Business Assistance. The Dash 4 provides that specified public records prepared for or received by the office are confidential and not subject to disclosure by the Office of Small Business Assistance. There's an exclusion for statutorily required reports, and there's an additional exemption that provides that communications to and from the Office of Small Business Assistance are confidential and exempt from disclosure. With the Dash 4 amendments, there's no fiscal impact, but we do not yet have a revenue impact statement.
Okay, thank you. Any order, please.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Caddy McEwen. For the record, I represent House District 9 down on the South Coast, and I will be very brief. This is a very simple bill. In 2013, I brought a bill, House Bill 3459, which created the Office of Small Business Assistance in the Secretary of State's office. This session, I was approached by the Office of Small Business Assistance to bring this bill in response to a string of communications that they had had with the Department of Justice regarding specifics around confidentiality between the office and the customer, our small businesses. What I'd like to do is, first of all, indicate that we had a number of parties at the table working on this to get to the Dash 4. It included the Department of Justice, Legislative Council. We had the Secretary of State's office involved and the Speaker's office. All parties involved are very well aware of the sensitive nature around public records request exemptions, and it is no one's intention with this bill to expand those exemptions. The bill was brought forward very specifically to clarify existing statute, not to expand public records exemptions in any way. And we are being very particular about this and think that collectively with a lot of smart people around the table that we have arrived at the correct language. The Dash 4s are here for your consideration today. And what I'd like to do is turn this over to my colleague, Representative Gomberg, who's been a supporter of the Office of Small Business Assistance since the very, very beginning, and then to Ms. Miles, who can explain it in detail if you have questions. So thank you very much, Chair Barker.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for your record, David Gomberg from House District 10 on the Oregon coast. And, you know, I absolutely congratulate Representative McEwen for bringing this concept forward a few years ago. And I also congratulate Ms. Miles for the remarkable job that she has done in implementing a concept that all of us approved. I regard the Office of Small Business Assistance as basically small business 911. You got a problem with an agency, you got a problem with a rule, you got a problem with a public employee. This is who you call for help. It's an emergency center for small businesses. And recently we have expanded their authority to go beyond simply working with state agencies, but empower them to help small business owners with any kind of public agency. But here's the problem. I'm a small business owner. I've got an issue. Am I going to call these folks if whatever I tell them about my business becomes public record? I don't want to share proprietary information. I don't want my competition to look at the Office of Small Business Assistance as a research center for their business. And that's essentially what we're talking about, is how do we protect sensitive information that is provided in the process of an inquiry or a complaint as this office's great work goes forward. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Ruth Miles. I'm the small business advocate. I run the Secretary's Office of Small Business Assistance. It was created to help business owners that are caught in red tape with state agencies, so I always like to joke that I run with scissors. Last year, my office began a rulemaking process at the request of the previous Secretary of State. Our purpose was simply to define the word complaint as it's used in our statutes and to clarify our procedures when a business owner files a complaint with our office regarding a state agency. Our Rules Advisory Committee is a group of business owners and associations that represent a large swath of Oregon's business community, our small business community, our primary customer. They asked us exactly what part of a case would be subject to public disclosure. So we asked for an opinion from Department of Justice to get clarity on that measure. When we got that opinion back, we were surprised to see that Department of Justice offered us two possible interpretations of the existing statute, which you can find in ORS 56.203 sub 4. So that existing statute that was part of the original bill that Representative McEwen carried, DOJ said their broad interpretation was that all of the casework, all of the conversations that happen with state agencies and small businesses in the context of a case would in fact be not subject to public disclosure. But the narrow interpretation, one that they felt they could defend in a legal setting, said that everything that was part of a case was subject to public disclosure and that nothing was confidential. This came as a surprise to our office, and I'm understating that greatly. So we started a conversation within the agency about asking for clarification in the statute so that we can draw a bright line for our customers, business owners in the state, and for state agencies that we work with collaboratively to solve the problems that business owners bring to us. So we were well past our filing deadline when we got this opinion. Representatives McEwen and Gomberg stepped forward and assisted us. Representative McEwen has eloquently stated why we have a Dash 4 amendment in front of you. But to give you the perspective of Secretary of State as the agency, the particular concern we have is that a public record that is already subject to public disclosure not be made private simply because it becomes part of a case conversation. So just as an example, if a construction contractor is licensed by the CCB, and that construction contractor files a complaint with our office regarding the CCB, their license record, any debt that they owe to the agency, any enforcement actions that the agency has taken against them in the past, that's currently part of a searchable database that is used by consumers, by professionals who are looking for construction contractors, and for vendors that want to do business with them. Those records should not become private just because they're part of a case conversation. So the Dash 4 amendments, we feel, have brought us to the point where the language is written clearly enough and tightly enough to encompass that particular concern, as well as draw a bright line for our business customers. So that gives you a high-level view of what brought us here today. If you have any questions, I'm certainly happy to answer them.
Thank you. Any questions, Representative Bile?
Thank you very much. I'm just curious as to whether we've seen any actual problems occur to date. Have we had information revealed that small business owners have been disconcerted because it was revealed?
Because of our confidentiality statute, or have had problems with state agencies?
Have we had that problem with state agencies?
Chair Barker, members of the committee, Representative Vile, yes, absolutely. Small businesses have problems with state agencies. And I'll give you a copy of this as I leave. But your office would have received a copy of our annual report in February this year. All of you would have received a flat copy of what is now this little tiny folded guy. But in this report, we give you a high-level overview of the kinds of data that we collect from businesses that are registering a concern with our office. And our goal is not just to solve the problem for the business, but then to work collaboratively with the state agency or the group of agencies that's named in the complaint to try and prevent the problem from happening again. But this will give you a very clear understanding of what kinds of problems are coming into the office.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman. Follow up. My apology. I didn't mean that portion. I meant have we actually had small businesses complain that records you have caused them to be hurt by having that information revealed to the public?
Chair Barker, members of the committee, Representative Vile, no, we haven't had that complaint specifically. We have had business owners express real concern that we haven't been able to provide a really clear, bright line. Instead, what we've been doing is providing them with the statute that is applicable, and we can't interpret that for them because Department of Justice disagrees with what the original legislative intent was, which was to keep these conversations private.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much.
Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you to all three of you for bringing this. I'm in agreement of where you want to be and the reason why you want to be there. I just want to be clear and on the record, we're not talking about keeping records confidential, as they would relate to the behavior of state agencies or agents of the state, that it's really the personal information of a business owner. I would not, as a business owner, I wouldn't want my profit and loss statement out there. That's my business. I maybe wouldn't want certain questions about employment practices out there. But I just want to be clear that not everything is going to be held confidential.
Do you want to take that or shall I, please? Chair Barker, Representative Springer. So in order to get at the things that business owners are concerned about having disclosed to the public or splashed on the cover of the Oregonian or the Register Guard, we then have to look at all of the things that they tell us. And so the bright line, the legislative intent, let me go to that, for the original bill that passed out of the 2013 session was that these conversations not be subject to public disclosure. If you look at the statute, that's literally what it says, that they're confidential and not subject to public disclosure. The reason that this bill is in front of you is not because we're seeking an expansion of the existing statute. It is simply because the attorneys at Department of Justice who would defend us if we had to get to a legal situation and the attorneys who drafted the original bill disagree about how to say what we meant. So that's simply the process that we're doing. So to answer your question more directly, we do have to include all of the conversations that we have with a business and that we have with a state agency in what remains confidential. That's the goal of this language. Thank you.
Any further questions?
Mr. Chair.
I've got the gavel.
Madam Chair.
Thank you.
You're not going to hit me.
Yeah. Wow, did you see that?
Can I ask a question?
I like that.
Sure.
You too.
I don't know.
In your discussions with the Department of Justice, did they give you some guidelines about what documents in state agencies are confidential or what age, or what items around state agency communications are not confidential? What's the general rule for that?
Chair Williamson, Representative Greenlink. No, they didn't actually do that. We asked them for two specific opinions that apply to this. The first opinion we asked them for was an opinion on the rules, the administrative rules that we were working on with our Administrative Rule Advisory Committee. And they provided that opinion. And that's when we learned that there was this discrepancy between what the statute says and what they felt they could defend in a legal setting. The second opinion we asked for was after Representatives Gomberg and McEwen agreed to introduce this bill, and the Department of Justice noticed that the bill was in LC form and provided us with some language that they felt would be a little bit better to express what we were hoping to do. But because we didn't ask them to provide us with a view of the landscape of public records law, I'm guessing that's why that wasn't included in their opinion.
May I follow up?
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me there ought to be some standard about what's confidential and what's not confidential and relating to public agencies. Okay. I guess it's not a question. It doesn't seem to be a question mark at the end of that.
Vice Chair Williamson, Representative Greenlink, I am certainly not qualified to answer that question. I'm certain we could find an answer for you. I'm sure there is. It just wasn't in the purview of us trying to solve this very small problem, which was to protect the confidentiality of the proprietary information that our small businesses may need to share as they're working with Ruth's office trying to solve a problem. So,
but we said in the original statute that this information should be kept confidential, and the Department of Justice says, well, we can't defend that. The question is, why can't they defend that? What is there in the original statute that would leave to ambiguity? It sounded pretty specific to me. And
sure.
We clear up the ambiguity just by saying it once again?
I'm sorry?
Are we going to clear up the ambiguity by repeating what we said in the original statute?
Chair Barker, Representative Greenlink, no. The language that you have in the dashboards and in the bill itself don't repeat the exact language. They amend the language of the existing statute. And our hope is that by getting all of the stakeholders to work on the language together, that we'll have something that is both legally defensible and clear to the businesses that we work with.
Mm-hmm. And that is what we did at the end of the day. Everybody at the table.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I thought you did very well in your brief.
Thank you. I've given up all my power. Go
ahead. Anybody else? Questions?
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, everyone.
Okay, the paperwork is not caught up yet. So close the public hearing on House Bill 3274. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2807.
That's okay.
Formally honorable. Thank you. And we'll call, go ahead, please.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 2807 is a placeholder relating to lawsuits. The Dash 2 amendment would require an affidavit submitted during the approval phase of a personal injury settlement for minors, incapacitated persons, and decedents to remain confidential under most circumstances.
Okay, thank you. Call Bruce Miller and the formerly honorable Brent Barton.
Formerly. Okay, amen.
I like that. That's
Ms. Great. Robin.
I see you, Batman.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Brent Barton. I'm an attorney in private practice. I was formerly honorable, and it is lovely to be here today. I'm here today on a bill that comes to you without opposition involving probate. And I like to think this is the kind of bill that will bring this committee and the two parties together. I know this because when I told several of you that I'm coming down on a very interesting probate bill, everyone just went, oh, no. Oh, no. I've heard it said that Representative Vile will probably have to carry this bill because I hear he's an even bigger law nerd than I am. So I'm glad you're carrying the torch, Representative. Chair Barker and members of the committee, this is a bill. I'm not sure how detailed you want me to go. When you settle a case on behalf of somebody who does not have capacity to make the determination on whether to settle a case themselves, 90% of the time we're talking about children, but it could be an adult or other disabled person who has a conservator making legal decisions for them. When you settle a case for somebody in that situation, a judge has to approve the settlement to make sure it's reasonable. That's a good policy. That's a good practice. The purpose of that is to basically to protect a disabled person from unscrupulous parents, guardians, lawyers, etc. As part of that process, you petition the court, not the trial court, but a separate probate court, to approve the settlement. The central document in that is something that we call an affidavit of reasonableness. For the lawyers in the committee, it's submitted pursuant to UTCR 9.040, if I recall correctly. And that essentially, it kind of almost takes the probate judge in under the attorney-client privilege. You outline a lot of confidential things like the client's medical prognosis, confidential health data, the strengths and weaknesses of your case, the identity of your experts potentially, things of that nature. And traditionally, you also file a corresponding motion to seal that affidavit so that it remains confidential. That has happened for years, if not decades. I don't know how long, but a long time. And that motion to seal has always been granted as a matter of course. Recently, judges in Marion County and Washington County have started pushing back on that motion to seal, meaning that confidential information could be subject to the public domain, including the settlement, financial details, health information, etc. So the House Bill 2807-2 makes this presumptively confidential. I think that will encourage the candid exchange of information from the trial counsel to the court. And again, I think it comes to you without any opposition. I, of course, represent injured people. I'm associated with the plaintiff's bar. I would note in the record is a letter from Don Templeton, who's writing in support of the Dash 1 amendments, although I think his argument would apply to the Dash 2. He is a noted defense lawyer. Defense lawyers also have interests in keeping these documents confidential. They're slightly different than the plaintiff lawyer's interests, but interest nonetheless. I'm happy to explain that if you'd like. Also with me today is Shannon Conley. She's actually a professional probate lawyer, neither plaintiff nor defense lawyer. She simply does trusts and estates. And Ms. Conley, I should warn you, I gave them probably more detail than they wanted. They're already asleep. So having said that, Mr. Chair, I'm happy to pass it on to either of my co-panelists.
Your choice.
Bruce, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Bruce Miller, senior counsel to the state court administrator. I had about half a dozen points to make. This has been a fast-moving target, and all of my points are irrelevant now that we have the Dash 2 amendment that we received just before the committee hearing began. I would point out that our read of the Dash 2 amendments is that the confidentiality provision does not prevent a judge or a court staff from viewing the affidavit because, of course, they need to see the affidavit to process the case. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Baker and the committee, apologies for being late, and I just wanted to give some background on this issue. I'll keep it brief, so it sounds like Mr. Parton has already discussed it in some detail. So whenever you have incapacitated...
You need to state your name for the record.
My name is Shannon Conley. I'm an attorney with the law offices of Ney and Friedenberg. Our practice is primarily in the probate court, so we do assist the trial attorneys regularly in obtaining approval for settlements that are reached on behalf of incapacitated minor and deceased individuals. So the reason that these proceedings must be brought is to obtain approval of settlement and to manage these funds following settlement. The affidavit that must accompany these pleadings often contain protected medical information as well as very detailed explanations of the injury that was incurred. They also contain the amount of net settlement that will be distributed to this vulnerable person. Despite the fact that this information is very personal, and that this particular class of people is very vulnerable, there is a handful of courts that consistently deny a request to seal the affidavit. Excuse me, I was running to the room, so I'm a little bit out of breath. For example, we recently had a matter that involved a sexual violence case against a minor disabled child. And despite the sensitive and personal nature of the affidavit, our request to seal was denied. Yes, and so we had extensive discussions with the court to come to something that would be a reasonable solution. And after all was said and done, we had to redact hundreds of pages of pleadings that were already filed. It cost the family an additional $3,000 to $4,000, and it delayed approval of the settlement for several months. And although this is an extreme case, it's not uncommon. So just right on the heels of that case, a situation with a very similar fact pattern came before us. And because of that precedence that was set by the trial judge, the probate judge, they decided to not even attempt to seal the affidavit. And so this family, you know, as parents, had to make that choice to have this sexual violence, you know, become public record because they didn't want the cost of an alternative to be borne by their child. So it's a very, it is a, like I said, a not an uncommon situation. And I would find that, you know, in the hundreds of thousands of files that we do in this type of area, the majority of them would benefit from this bill passing to protect them. And if they were able to enter into settlement agreements individually, they would have the option to keep this confidential. And I think this bill extends that opportunity to this very vulnerable class as well. So thank you.
Thank you. Representative Bach.
Mr. Chairman, The amendments specifically state that the affidavit is not subject to inspection except pursuant to a court order entered after a showing of good cause. I really like the idea. I'm trying to figure out what good cause might be. What are going to be the exceptions if we adopt this?
Chair Barker and Representative Vile, I was warned in advance that you would ask the hard questions on a probate bill. And I would defer to committee counsel as well. My understanding is that good cause is a standard that already exists in public records law. If I recall correctly, it's 192.101 or 501, I think, is already there's a, I think it's, I might be conflating that and within the public interest. I could be wrong. But so that isn't already a standard that exists. Now, what, like any standard, is by nature nebulous. What exactly does that mean? I'm not really sure. An alternative we could do is truly put it in a black box so that the court doesn't have any discretion at all. But I suppose when I actually sat in that exact chair, I always pushed back against that because I thought that there might be various situations in life in which maybe it is in the public interest and this does need to be disclosed. I don't know what they would be, but it's hard to anticipate everything when you're in this committee. So I felt it would be very hypocritical of me to then try and put it in a black box with no escape valve.
Fair enough. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, just for the record, it is unless the public interest requires disclosure is the standard.
Okay, no further questions. Thank you very much, panel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We're going to go with
okay. And so we're not ready to paper roll this one over. Also, I need to say we're rolling over 3087 so we can do the work session on that. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2545. And Representative Hack, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2545 authorizes deception detection examination administrator to proctor a deception detection examination, exempts these examinations and administrators from the regulation by the Department of Public Safety standards and trainings. There are two amendments posted on OLIS. The dash one eliminates language referring to an ocular motor test, and the dash two prohibits the use of these devices in pre-employment decisions. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Barker, co-chairs, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jody Hack, and I represent House District 19. And I get to bring to you today House Bill 2545. And we're going to have some folks here that are going to talk in detail about the iDetect. One of the things I would like to bring to your attention, I believe that the Dash 2 amendment also clarifies that it's not just for iDetect. But also for other means of detection that could be used also. So it's not specifically just to iDetect. I spent some time talking with the Sheriff's Association, Department of Corrections, Board of Probation and Parole, have not had anyone in opposition. This is merely a tool in the to put in the toolbox for those folks, not anything that they have to use. But this is some new technology that's been out there that 33 other states have the ability to use the technology. And so this is merely just a way for Oregonian or Oregon to be able to use, an option, don't have to, but just a tool to have in the toolbox. And I honestly have not had a chance to look at the Dash 2s, but I think that the Dash 2s did take care of some concern that Chair Barker, you had, and also Vice Chair Williamson had some good thoughts on how we might put that language together so that it wasn't just iDetect, but could be used for others as well and would be up to, I believe it was a DCBS that would have the authority, I think it was?
DPSST,
sorry, excuse me, to decide how they wanted to, what they wanted to do with that. So with that, I'll turn it over to some others that know a whole lot more about it, but again, I have not heard from anyone that was in opposition, so it's been real favorable.
And thank you for coming over, please.
Hi.
Excuse me, sorry.
My name is Robert Gross, and I'm a retired Lane County Sheriff's Deputy, spent 27 years there, retired in 2005. And for 25 years, I've been working as a volunteer with a sex offender treatment counselor by the name of Peter Shannon, who has his practice in Eugene, Oregon. During that time, I've done three groups of treatment groups of consisting of 10 to 12 men weekly, and we've had hundreds of people go through treatment. It takes usually 3 to 7 years to go through. It takes that long to get somebody to where they are most likely not going to be a problem in the community any longer. A part of that treatment is having people accountable and not being hiding or deceptive with behaviors. You don't want somebody in treatment who is secretly viewing pornography, secretly having contact with minors, unreported absences from jurisdiction, drug use,
things like that. And so polygraph has been used by Mr. Shannon and others to help verify that none of this is going on. It's not a perfect tool. And that's what motivated me to go to polygraph school. I got the training, acquired an examiner's license, an intern examiner's license, and was doing exams for Mr. Shannon in his assessments. It was last year that I went to a training up in Washington and first saw the iDetect. And I'd been hoping for this for a long time. I'd been following it, wanted to see if it had been developed. And it's very different. Polygraph is not iDetect. iDetect is not polygraph. They cannot be combined. They are totally separate. And so basically, let me give you, in a nutshell, what iDetect is. If polygraph measures your breathing, your blood pressure, electrical conductivity of your skin, that sort of thing, puts it through a chart and it's interpreted, the data is interpreted by the polygraph examiner, and then they give an opinion. iDetect doesn't work on any of that. It works on cognitive load. And what I mean by that, let me explain what that is. If I were to say to you, what's 2 times 9? You're going to go, oh, 18, right? You got it just like that. What if I say to you, what's 9 times 17? You'll get it. It's 153, but it's going to take you just that much longer. And what the developer of the computerized polygraph discovered, and he's been working at the University of Utah doing deception research for 30 years. 15 years ago, he and another colleague wondered if that hesitation, that additional cognitive load, would create markers that could be seen. And so what they developed over the past 15 years was a test that looks at what you're doing right here. Each one of you is looking at a computer screen. You sit at a computer screen with a mouse. You click on true-false questions, and it takes 90,000 samples of eye dilation and constriction in a 30-minute period. Then it sends all that data up. It runs through an algorithm and gives you a report in 10 minutes. It is, at present, as effective as the best polygraph. It costs a third to half of what a polygraph does. If an agency like parole and probation wants to have it, they can train their staff in an afternoon to administer the tests. All the tests are pre-written. They're researched. They can't be changed. The data can't be tweaked or corrupted, and you get the report. It's a tool. That's what it is. It's just a tool. It's another tool. The polygraph statute was written in 1975. That's when we had brick phones. And all I'm asking is that you consider upgrading so that all the technology that has been developed in 40 years that each one of you are using and each one of you has in your pocket can be used as a tool. Not a mandated, it's an imperfect tool, but it's pretty darn good. And let me just close by saying this. There's a simple test that we give that just shows the efficacy of it. It takes about 8 minutes. And basically this test is you write a number down between 2 and 9, you stuff it in your pocket or put it under a piece of paper, and we'll give you about an 8-minute test. And that's about the minimum data that you need for the algorithm to make a determination. I've done 15 of those, 15 correct answers, from people as young as 10 years old to 68, because those markers are there, they're observable, and you can see them, and the algorithm can determine when somebody is being deceptive or not. And what's interesting about that is Neil, who he was going to be here today, Neil Harris, who is a representative from the company, went back and presented this to a polygraph conference, did 65 tests, 60 times it got it right. And that's not just a coin flip where it's 50-50. It's a 1 out of 8. 60 times. So it's an amazing technology. It's a useful tool. And the application that I'm really interested in is this. It is vitally important, especially if you're treating sex offenders and you're wondering, can we put them in the community? Can we lower their level of supervision? Can we start to reintegrate them with family? Do we let them go on passes? If you can have an additional piece of data that will really give you an indication, are they in compliance? Are they hiding behaviors that just haven't been caught? And same thing with parole and probation. You come into your parole and probation officer whose cases are insane. Who do you look at close? Who do you spend your resources on? And so you come in, and your monthly meeting is go take a half-hour test, see if you've left the jurisdiction, had unauthorized contact with people, drug use, and find out whether that's gone on or not. And you can have then an idea of who you need to put your resources to and who not. It's a tool, and I think it's wonderful.
Hey, thank you very much for your testimony. Anybody have any quick questions? Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Trying to wrap my head around this. So this would not be a part of a criminal investigation. I'm assuming it doesn't have standing as evidence in court.
No.
Correct. Follow up, Mr. Chair. So this would be, the amendment talks about employment situations, but you're also talking about part of probation or parole?
I can answer that. Okay. Try to anyway. Chair Barker and Representative Springer. The amendment is making it clear that you cannot use it to screen employment. So cannot do that. And it's not legal in a court of law. So it's merely a tool in the toolbox if you decided you wanted to use it in corrections or anything like that.
Go ahead.
Paula, so this would be used in a correction setting? When would it be used?
It could be used in that fight at the prison. Who started it, those kind of things. It's used in, I don't want to say in place of, but it would be similar to a polygraph, but it's a different system.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment. I think it's good to have more tools. However, I don't trust the polygraph, and I have problems with this concept, too, because it's not 100% reliable.
Chair Barker and Representative Gorsuch, I think one of the things that was interesting to me, and we actually had them come in and they did a test, and some of the folks that were there will come up and testify that were in the room when they did that, and they did catch him being deceptive. I think what was interesting to me is they said oftentimes you'll put them in front of the computer, and after they've caught him in a lie, they'll oftentimes come back up and they just confess. And they'll say, don't even put me on that. I started the fight. I stole whatever out of his cell. I did. So that oftentimes.
Can I comment on also?
Yeah.
I also, honestly, share your hesitation with polygraph. This is why I'm not doing polygraphs anymore. I want to go to this. And let me tell you why, if I can be just real honest. Okay. It's hard to test somebody on a very volatile issue and get a good, clean test because there's so much fear. If I don't pass this test, oh, my God, what happens to me? And so you may get just fear that you're seeing. This doesn't care about that. This just cares about what part of your brain is engaging to answer the question. Mm-hmm. It doesn't care if you think it's right or wrong. It doesn't matter. The same way with the number, 2 times 9. You will use more of your brain, and that will generate the markers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Next, I'll call Jeremiah Stromberg, Michael Salvaggio, and Eric. Do you want to come up as well? Or you don't have to if you don't want to.
He wants to.
I don't know what it means.
Yeah.
Sure. Okay, here comes the sheriff. And I appreciate it you could do this quickly because we still have a lot to do today, we hope.
Sure.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Michael Silvaggio here representing the Oregon Coalition of Police and Sheriffs. We represent line officers and sheriff's deputies around the state. We like the idea of more tools in the toolbox. I want to thank Representative Hack for bringing this forward and providing those tools to our public safety professionals. We are here pushing for the Dash 2 amendments, which, as was noted, provide that this does not create a loophole around existing restrictions in ORS 659 and ORS 659A. We understand in talking with the sponsor and stakeholders that the intent of this measure is as stated, to provide those tools, not to get around the other unrelated chapters. So in an abundance of caution, we're asking that you attach the Dash 2 amendments. Thank you.
Okay, thank you,
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jason Myers. I'm the Marion County Sheriff. I've had a chance to look over this House bill, and I'm supportive of it and the concept. This emerging science and technology appears to be really good. We already use polygraph right now as a part of supervision, especially for sex offenders. I could see this working in conjunction with that, as well as in our correctional facility, our transition center, where we have people leave on day passes. Oftentimes we use urine analysis, that gets spendy. This is another tool we could use to verify whether somebody's using drugs or bringing things into the facility. Again, I think I see it bundled together to help aid us in changing behavior and keeping our correctional facility safe. So thank you.
Thank you.
And Chair Barker, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Jeremiah Stromberg, Assistant Director with the Department of Corrections. And similar to Sheriff Myers, as we supervise offenders in the community, we use a number of technologies, house arrest, GPS monitoring, smartphone applications. And this, as you've heard, would be another tool available to us. Not the end-all be-all, and certainly not what we would use to determine a final violation of supervision. But who do we need to press more and question more and perhaps send for a polygraph or do some additional investigation or digging to determine what's going on here and why are we having problems with honesty, as certainly that's the first step towards accountability as we supervise these individuals. And so we, too, would appreciate the opportunity to have more tools at our avail. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions, panel? Any more further questions? Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, can I?
Yes. Okay, please.
I'm a little puzzled. We're not talking about using this in criminal cases.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. And we're not talking about using it in employment. And it's a technology. What stops us from using the technology now? I mean, you can use anything, right? On anything.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my guess would be this fits under the current definition of polygraph. Which has to do with measuring the body's to detecting truth based on physiological responses. I'm not 100% certain of that. I could spend some time looking at it, but that would be my guess for the necessity of the statute.
And this broadens the language to say all new technology. So because the other one says polygraph, this isn't a polygraph. So and so this one and the next one.
It isn't a polygraph, so why is it covered under the polygraph definition?
Okay. Representative. Go ahead, Representative.
For the record, Jody Hack, representing House District 19. I believe that it's under current ORS 703.310, mm-hmm. and it has to do with polygraph equipment requirements. So it's pretty specific on what equipment you can and can't use in the state of Oregon. So what this would do is just to open it up to other uses of equipment.
But as you said, that's under polygraph equipment, and your argument is this is not polygraph. This is something else. So why would it come under the polygraph definition?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative. The statute says you can't use an instrument or mechanical device for the purpose of detecting truth unless it complies with DPSST rules on polygraph. So it's because it's a truth detector.
You can't use it for anything?
Correct. Anything relating to truth or deception, polygraph or otherwise.
You can't use it to A person may not use any instrument or mechanical device to test or question an individual for the purpose of detecting deception or verifying the truth of statements that does not comply with the minimum requirements adopted by the department.
And if this passes, it would be then the department of DPSSC.
Well, then this is putting this at par with the existing polygraph.
No.
And that would say we need to have, I need to have some testimony.
So
here comes
Chair Barker.
Here comes the judge.
Coming.
Coming.
So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Eric Skalbix, Director of Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. What you're really looking at is a statute that's more than 30 years old when polygraph was created. This is new technology, as you've heard from the panel, that they would like to have used in the state. We haven't seen the dash one. They're not up yet. But our look at the original one, we're neutral on the bill, but it doesn't cause us any concern, because what you're saying is that you're allowing this device to be used, and you're also saying that these people will not be under the requirements of a polygraph examiner, so they won't be DPSST licensed. So really, it just allows this device to be used in the state of Oregon, because under what it does, it meets the definition of what polygraph says it is. But that, as I said, that definition is more than 30 years old when that statute was created. And I think looking into the future, this is probably one of many new things that are going to be designed. And one of the members contacted us about this bill and said, can you look into this and tell us if this is good or not? We don't have the staff. I wouldn't even know where to find a person to look into this and tell you if it's good or not. That's not what we're there for.
So who's here to tell us if it is good or not? You came up and answered my question. We have scientific evidence that this works.
And Coach Chair Barker, Representative Greenlake, from DPSST, we're not the Consumer Product Safety Commission, for lack of better terms. We don't have the ability to look at these things. For example, polygraph, there's a number of different polygraph machines that are used. We don't go out and look at the different machines and say, do they all work, do they not? It's a science. What we look at through the statute is that the people operating those machines have met a minimum standard that's going through a polygraph school. This is very different than that, because this is new and emerging. And as you heard, this is relatively easy to use as opposed to polygraph.
There was a long history of scientific evidence of the use of polygraph, where apparently, if our statutes regulate the use of these kind of equipment, then shouldn't we be saying, well, this has some validity, this has strong scientific evidence? And I'm not saying it doesn't, but it seems to me it ought to be something we should be testing before we add something that otherwise couldn't be used in the state. You may have already violated its use by having a demonstration on it, I assume.
Chair Barker.
Yes.
And Representative Greenlake, 33 states have done what we're doing. So, I mean, 33 other states have allowed other options besides just...
Will you vote for anything that's been done by 33 states? Can I bring you anything else and you accept it? But so you say, well, wait a minute. What is that you're telling me 33 states have accepted?
33 states have, excuse me, my apologies, Chair Barker and Representative Greenlake. I'm just stating that 33 states have also utilized the iDetect system, that they've passed legislation to utilize it.
Representative Vile.
I think that it's important for us to recognize that all this does is recognize the existence of the
technology
system. It doesn't say that it's available to be used in a criminal environment as evidence. And more importantly, it says it's not available as evidence, and it's not available, we can't use it for employment purposes. So the most important thing about this bill is what we can't use it for, and it simply recognizes that it's out there. And I think because that's the case, it really is the right step to take right now. It doesn't answer Representative Greenlake's question, but we don't need to answer that question yet, because it's not for any purpose that would be equivalent of polygraph.
Why do we need a statute? I mean, that gets back to
so that we know what we can't use it for. That, I think, is the most important part right now. Let's folks get out there and begin using it, but protects us for the stuff that we shouldn't be using
so
it for.
So if we didn't pass the statute, they can use it in employment? Any company can just hire it?
I think so.
And the purpose of the statute is to stop it from being used? So why don't we just do that? Have a passage that says
It limits the use.
This can't be used. Well, it does more than that. It puts it into, it gives it people.
Oh, my gosh.
I'm sorry. No, that's okay. You have a lot to do.
No, that's all right.
Well, Chair Barker, Representative Greenlee, a few months ago, I'm sorry, Eric Salvich for the record, a few months ago, one of the Polygraph members brought up this device. We went down, our staff member went down, looked at the equipment, they went through the test, and really at the end of the day, we did this. We said, the person never said that they're taking a polygraph exam. They weren't portraying it as such. Even though they were a former polygrapher, they didn't claim that they're doing this as a polygraph examiner. And they also, at the end of that, we said, this is not the same as a polygraph. So what we have is an old statute with new technology. This allows this to be used, and the statute basically says this isn't a polygraph. And the people using it don't have to be licensed as a polygraph examiner.
Representative Gorsuch.
Thank you, Chair. So, Mr. Gablix, if it's not a polygraph, but it's doing something like a polygraph, so shouldn't it be somehow certified by DPSST if polygraphs are certified? And that seems to me, I think it kind of gets at what Representative Greenlee is saying.
Chair Barker, Representative Gorsuch, so it's a policy question, right. but the other thing is that how large of a role do you want DPSST to be involved in this? So I'll just share with you the discussion we had on the way over, is we have less than 50 polygraph examiners in the state. What we really are doing is licensing them to work in the occupation. They've gone through a professional training program that they've spent months doing. I understand the discussions about the science, and we hear that as well. Really, all we're doing is through our process, and I'm diminishing it because it's an important part of what we do, but we're saying that the people providing this have been trained to a certain standard. We're not saying how competent they are. We're not saying that they're an A student or C student. We're just saying that they've met the occupational standard to do this work.
So, but my question is, if you certify people who went through a training program for polygraph, why wouldn't you certify people who went through a training for this?
Chair Barker, Representative Gorsuch, I guess we could. The question is, how do we do it, and what does it cost us to do it, and all those other things? Because we honestly don't have expertise in this area, and we rely on a group of constituents to help with the polygraph. But this is new, and I think this is probably the future of many things that are going to be developed to come. And I don't know if this body wants us to be all things to all people. That's really the policy question.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Okay, the bill's not ready to move today, so thank you for your testimony. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2545 and roll it over, and then open a public hearing on House Bill 2812.
It's Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2812 directs DHS and OIA to conduct a statewide study. It is a placeholder. The Dash 2 Amendment replaces the measure. The Dash 2 Amendment requires the Department of Education to establish the School Safety Multidisciplinary Assessment Team System to assist school personnel in addressing situations concerning students engaged in violence, posing a threat of violence, or exhibiting suicidal behavior. It requires the system to offer training and technical assistance and provide other support. It includes representative from Morgan Health Authority who has specialty in suicide intervention and prevention on Task Force on School Safety. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I don't have anybody signed up. Sheriff, you were going to...
Is this one ready to go?
No, nothing.
Sure. Identify yourself, please.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jason Myers. I'm Marion County Sheriff. I'm here today testifying in support of House Bill 2812. With the adoption of Dash 2 amendments, I'm testifying on behalf of the Sheriff's Association and the Oregon Chiefs Association. Unfortunately, the chair of this committee was not able to make it today. That's Clackamas County Sheriff Craig Roberts. He has a child abuse summit going on in Portland and is tied up with that. This bill is kind of like part two of a task force that I know that Chair Barker has been involved with around our schools and school safety. And the recommendation coming forward is around creating these multidisciplinary teams, similar to the teams that we have here in Marion County that work with the school districts in Marion County that can assess and deal with issues that come forward around student threats, whether that's self-harm or threats to the school. And so we are very supportive of this action. School safety is a high priority, I know, for all of us. And I believe this puts it with the Department of education. So I would be happy to answer any questions that you might have, and just know that this is an important topic for our associations and obviously for you.
Any questions? So is this ready to go?
Nothing's ready to go.
Wow.
Wow. Seriously.
Okay.
We are rolling today. Okay. There are work sessions that are ready, but we're going to get there.
Okay.
Let the sheriff go.
Pardon me?
Can we let him go?
Yeah, sheriff. Thank you very
much. Thank you very much.
Anybody else who wants to testify?
We'll have the sheriff to stand.
We're going to close the public hearing on 2812.
For his own recognizance.
And right. We'll stand by for a moment. I'm just going to do it from here.
Okay.
It'll be really easy.
I have a lot for you.
Yep, there you go.
No, I'm just kidding.
So, committee members, I just want to share with you. Well, okay, go ahead. I guess you need to better stop right there.
The guy to earn his pay.
1243, sorry.
Members of the committee, House Bill 2826 requires courts to impose and not suspend a minimum sentence of imprisonment when an individual is convicted of fleeing or attempting to elude a police officer while traveling at least 30 miles over the speed limit. The minimum sentence is also required if the fleeing individual drives through a residential or business district or school zone. A first conviction for this crime would result in a minimum sentence of 30 days imprisonment. A second conviction would result in a sentence of 60 days, and any subsequent convictions would result in 90 days sentence.
Thank you. Very good. So, all right. As soon as the chair gets back, sits down, we'll get started. So, Mr. Chair, we're moving forward, and I'm going to share a little bit about this House bill. Deputy Herman on the phone, do you know? He's going to call in.
Wait a minute. Take the number.
Mm-hmm. He's babysitting today.
That happens. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, this is Mike. Leave a message.
Okay, so I'll move on.
Go ahead, Mike.
Mike's not ready.
Anyways, Mr. Chair.
Wow.
Who's ready?
You know,
let's make this official. I'm going to go down here. You know?
Okay.
That way you'll feel a little more comfortable. Okay, so Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Andy Olson, state representative out of the Albany area, and House Bill 2826 comes to you as a result of some discussions over the last few years from a deputy from Jackson County Sheriff's Office. And bottom line is they've experienced a lot of problems with attempt to elude, whether they're the Class A felonies, Class C felonies or the Class A misdemeanors. And what's happening is that the offenders hardly get any time at all in the local jail as a result of it. He was wanting to, along with the sheriff's office down there, wanting to know if there's anything that we can do. So you have 2826. And the idea behind that is that, as counsel, there are some aggravated factors in the one section here that I want to just kind of go over. Section 1, sub 4, talks about that if a person drives 30 miles over the speed limit, in excess of the speed limit, or is designated speed posted, or drives in a residential district, a business district, or school zone when a person commits the offensive, as described in this, which would be attempting to elude a police officer, upon conviction, it's graduated. So the first offense would be 30 days. The second offense would be 60 days. And the third offense would be 90 days. And that's a minimum mandatory. That is in the county jail. It doesn't have anything to do with the Department of Corrections. And the key piece on this whole thing is that Criminal Justice Commission did some crunching of numbers on that. That would only impact about 24 beds a year. So it's really a low number, but it could very easily resolve a lot of the problems of offenders out there that are just getting to a point where they want to elude a police officer. So I, you know, the chiefs and the sheriff's associations are supportive of this bill, and that's how simple this bill is.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative
Springer.
Springer, yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My only concern is, I love the idea, is, so this is obviously, we're talking days, so we're talking jail, not prison.
Could you speak into the microphone, please? Thank you. Thank you.
So sorry about that,
Dave.
Representative Olson. Can you hear me now? So my concern is those counties that have very depleted resources, and they would be required to do the 30 days. And I would venture to say I can think of one or two counties that maybe don't have an operating jail. Would they have to pay then another county to house this person for 30 or 60 days?
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative Springer, great question. And essentially, yes. I mean, because they would have to comply with what the statute is on that. And I do believe that, you know, like for just for example, Benton County Sheriff's Office, they purchase beds and have them for within three different other counties.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Representative.
Which is not good.
Mary Sell.
Well,
good afternoon, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Mary Sell. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and I do want to offer some comments on HB 2826. We are opposed, and there are just a few reasons that we are. From a policy standpoint, OCDLA does not support mandatory minimum sentences. One of the main reasons is we do believe that the judge should retain discretion to consider aggravation and mitigation of that specific case. When you impose mandatory minimum sentences, you are essentially discounting the court's ability to make the right call, and you are discounting all of the good reasons to allow people to enter probation and not always have a jail or prison sentence. Second, court discretion on sentencing is important in this type of crime. Eluding as a felony is a level 2 on the guideline grid, and so I'm assuming everyone has at this point seen the guidelines grids. What a level 2 means is the court has essentially 90 custody units total to impose on this type of crime, and we're talking about this crime as a felony. When you impose mandatory minimums in this type of sentence, so either 30, 60, or 90 days, you're using most, if not all, of those custody units right up front. The reason why this matters from a law enforcement standpoint is when someone's on probation, a lot of times the hammer that is used is imposing more jail time to get that person to comply. So if you're imposing most, if not all, of this custody time up front, there's not going to be custody time left for the sentencing judge. And so I, from a policy standpoint, that doesn't make much sense to us to use all that time up front. Additionally, when we were talking with our legislative committee, they brought up something that is really kind of a nuanced legal issue. Under 419C-370, juveniles are often waived in most counties into adult court on boating and traffic offenses, meaning that they're not dealt with in juvenile court, but they're dealt with in municipal or circuit courts. In this case, under this law, a juvenile would be required to serve a mandatory sentence. Our position is that this decision should really remain up to the judge. The judge who's sentencing will know the situation of that juvenile better than we do here today, and better than a blanket imposition of time. We believe that the judge can make that decision appropriately. Additionally, when juveniles are waived into adult court, they would then be subject to imprisonment in an adult jail. This is problematic, and that's something that I think some of the bill, I think there's one bill up being considered now to specifically say that juveniles could be committing Measure 11 crimes cannot be placed in the DOC, but I don't think that there's anything preventing a juvenile from being imprisoned in jail in adult court, or excuse me, adult jail, essentially, if they're waived into adult court on a crime like this. And so that's a concern. And so I think that that there is a missing piece in this law in regards to juveniles. And lastly, the way that this law is written, it essentially says either you're driving in a residential, a business, or a school zone, or you're driving more than 30 miles over the posted speed limit. What's kind of interesting is in most of the cases that I've had, probably two or three have been high-speed chases over the course of 5 years, and most of them were people just taking longer than reasonable to stop, but they weren't necessarily speeding. And so a lot of times these kind of slow stops, which are often charged as eludes, are people in business, residential, or school zones. When you look at someone going 30 miles over the speed limit, and often that's on a highway, or someone doing a slow stop, those two situations are ultimately different. And so for them to be treated the same under this law just doesn't, from our perspective, make a policy, doesn't make sense from a policy standpoint. And so for those reasons, we are asking for you to vote no on this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions?
You know, Mr. Chair, I just want to say that there's four of us who have been probably involved in chases over the years.
Mm-hmm.
I rarely have I ever seen anybody taking their time to slow down and stop in the middle of an attempt to elude. They don't care about anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I don't get where you're getting on that.
And Chair Barker, Representative Wilson, I understand your comment, and I'm just giving anecdotal evidence from cases that I've seen. And I'm in, you know, as a lawyer, as an officer of the court, I'm being upfront about the cases that I've seen. I agree that there are high-speed chases, and I know that those exist. I haven't handled very many of those. More of the cases that I dealt with were people who were appropriately charged with attempting to elude, but it wasn't a high-speed chase. And that's the only comment that I was trying to make.
Representative Springer, please.
I got to thank you, Mr. Chair. I got to pile on that.
Okay.
I can think of one elude I was in. It never ended up being a high-speed chase. He wouldn't stop. We were out in the country. I kept following him. When we finally got to a stoplight and I looked at him, let's just say I can read lips sometimes, and it was clear what he said to me.
Sure.
And then he peeled off from that light. That's when the chase was on. And he didn't have time to go 80 miles an hour because there was another light, and we found ourselves in downtown, not going even probably 50, but the wrong way on one-way streets. And he stopped when he was pitted with two cop cars. So the point being, speed wasn't a factor there, but he had no intention of ever stopping for me, nor getting out of the vehicle, quite frankly. And he was extricated out of the vehicle. So it's not just extricated, it's a nice word. So, and that's all in the report and all above board.
Absolutely.
But the point being, they're not all speed related, but I think wrong way on downtown one-way streets is extremely dangerous.
Absolutely. Okay. I agree.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for the
thank you so much.
We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2826, and we're rolling everything over that was on the agenda today. Everything. Adjourned. Thank you, committee. Everything. Adjourned. Thank you, committee.